take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good morning, and welcome to Foraging Ahead. Today is art, artists, and ritual. We'll be foraging into parades, processions, carnival, giant puppets, and the misogosh of signifiers, that is Christmas, with Sophia Michaelis and Alex Kahn from the Processional Arts Workshop. These are the folks who design the puppets for and kick off the Halloween parade in New York City. I cornered them in their workshop while they were preparing for next weekend's Santa Claus celebration in Rhinebeck. They are processional artists, and we'll be talking about what they do, how they do it. We'll be getting in the preview of this year's Santa Claus celebration, as well as learning about the fancy sailor and his stick in the traditional Trinidadian carnival parades. So, here we go. Now I'm talking with Sophia Michaelis of the
Professional Arts Workshop.
And this is Santa Claus Central at the moment.
This is what we call the celebration space. Otherwise known as the center space.
Uh-huh.
This is where we build the new elements for the parade that is kind of the culmination of Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
And because the space was big enough, we're actually sharing the space with this other activity that is more geared towards kids, which is Crowns and Branches, which is that's what you hear all these like rustling.
I'm hearing crowns and branches. We have bins of beads and trinkets and material, and there's glue. This is like a craft heaven. There's just ribbons and
lots of little girls
and lots of little girls just looking at shiny baubles.
So what they're doing in the front part of the room is that they anyone can come in, but it's mainly for the kids. The idea is that on the day of Santa Claus, kids are the honored. They're like the kings and queens for the day.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You guys have done processions, mm-hmm. parades, all over the world for years now. Your big one, obviously, is in New York City, mm-hmm. the Halloween parade, which you, sadly didn't get to do this year.
No, we got hurricaned out,
uh-huh.
superstormed out.
So, and you build the puppets and for that, but also the concept. I mean, it's your...
Yeah, so the Halloween parade is where Alex and I got our start doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And our job for that is to design a performance that leads the parade. And the performance sort of articulates a theme that we propose to mm-hmm. the director of the parade each year. And that's a way for us to sort of dig deeper into aspects of holiday, the
uh-huh.
Halloween,
right.
that we that is relevant to us.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's more we're looking at cliches of Halloween. Like a few years ago, we were looking at ghosts and why do ghosts look the way they do? Why is that costume of, you know, you throw a sheet on your head and you cut out two holes? Where does that image come from? I mean, obviously the concept of spirits
mm-hmm.
is as old as humanity. But and we started looking into that and realized that there's this really interesting connection between the birth of photography and the birth of spiritualism. So the idea of being able to have a spiritual experience, and particularly the seances and contacting the dead,
right.
separate from religion.
So
those two
modern ghosts come from double exposures.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And there was a brisk market in selling double exposure portraits to people who are desperately hoping to find their loved ones, because when photography was first invented, nobody knew what it could do. I mean, it was this amazing thing. It was this amazing technology that maybe you could speak to your Aunt Rosie who had died a few years before. And, you know, nobody knew what the limitations... It seemed so incredible that it, you know,
well, you still,
why not?
You can, but she just won't
Well,
talk
and
back.
In this case, you couldn't talk to her, but you could see her. She would appear.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so...
So you found that ghosts, the art image of ghosts comes from the early days, like the late 19th century, early 20th century.
And even actually, late 1800s was the birth of photography, but you probably remember the date when it...
Well, no, 1850s.
1850s, yeah. Second half of the 1800s. You said century, sorry, I got distracted. But that performance for the Halloween parade, we did our research and we got really into this idea. And so we had this whole performance with these giant ghosts made out of silk that would... They were 18 feet tall.
Right.
And their faces were made out of... We took prints from the Library of Congress and then printed them on silk. I mean, early photographs, daguerreotypes, and printed them on silk. And so they were just these giant bodies of silk with these faces, and they would...
From history.
Real people.
So they were, actual ghosts.
They were actual ghosts.
It's entirely possible that somebody in the audience saw their great-grandmother 18 feet tall and sailing through the air, illuminated.
Yeah.
I mean, the odds are not very good, but it's possible.
It's New York. Anything could happen.
You figure a million people watching, and 13 ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
At least one in 10, I'd say.
This is Alex Kahn, the other half of... Processional Arts Workshop. We just came back from getting Gorilla Glue.
Gorilla Glue, half-inch well pipe, and a quarter-inch dowel. Everything you need to make a bunch of burrokeets.
A bunch of...
Burrokeets.
We haven't gotten to the burrokeets yet. We're still talking about this.
I don't know.
I'm guessing it's just a flying ass.
Basically.
Yeah.
One of the... when people look to their sort of predecessors for influences, painters might look back to Matisse or Picasso. We look to Carnival traditions.
Mm-hmm.
We spent 6 months in Trinidad studying various archetypes of Carnival culture there. And one of the characters that has been a stock character in Trinidadian Carnival, as well as other South and Central American Carnivals, is the burroquid, which is a...
Oh, you see, I was thinking combination of burro and parakeet.
That's what I thought when I first heard the word, but it's Q-U-I-D. But in Trinidad, they do a lot of kind of bastardized Spanish, so in their case, it might even be K-E-E-T. But anyway, it's basically the wearable horse, where the puppeteer who's carrying the horse also becomes the rider.
Oh.
And, it's a form that goes way back. You can see it in medieval carnivals.
Oh, kind of like the pantomime. Is that like the pantomime horse or the guy riding the horse?
Yeah, it's a little different because in the pantomime horse, they're both inside like a horse costume. It's like the vaudevillian thing.
But then the guy who's riding the horse is around him.
That's
and
it.
Okay. And we have one here. Is that one coming?
Yeah, that's the prototype.
The beginning of a burroquet, not to be confused with a flying ass.
Well, I don't know. We don't know what these things are going
to be. So now you're working on Sinterklaas. Sorry to hear. I mean, Halloween parade obviously canceled. And you did a lot of research. Do you do a lot of research for every parade that you plan?
Yeah, it's almost a reason for doing it. It's
to research and to discover something new.
Yeah. I mean, the last project we did was at Columbia University,
mm-hmm.
and it was called the Imagined City, and it was all about utopian architecture. And so, we spent a month looking at Le Corbusier, Le Radieux, and, Galileo's cenotaph, and all of these great, Frank Lloyd Wright, the Mile High Buildings, all these great structures and urban spaces that were never created.
Mm.
And staged it in a place where urban planning has been a source of great debate and contention. I mean, this is the site, basically, of the Columbia University riots, which were over the placing of a gymnasium or the proposed placement of a gymnasium in Morningside Park. So we actually paraded through Morningside Park with an illuminated imaginary city where everybody got to invent their own utopian ideal of urban space, make one building from that space, and then gradually collect them and aggregate them as the parade moved on. So we'd have sort of these stagings of this city that would then disassemble and reassemble. But the background for that was a couple of weeks of just reading into, you know, how have people thought about urban space over the years, from St. Augustine all the way up through, you know, In the Night Kitchen, you know, which is a fantastic imagined urban space. You know, the Maurice Sendak book,
yeah.
You know, Quaker Oats containers as buildings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, yeah, as soon as there were urban centers, there were people thinking, we could really do this better.
Yeah. And I mean, that's just one example. That what we're trying to do is tell stories through procession. And the stories are grounded in history. Sometimes they're grounded in, you know, ethnic concerns.
I mean, it's listening to Sophia sort of explain the wonderful depths that you went to just to find, just to make ghosts for Halloween. People more often than not will not know all the connections that you're making,
right?
To, because people bring their own expectations to a parade. I mean, there's a template. People have a form. They've seen parades. They're usually sort of martial exercises in this country. We don't really, except for New Orleans and now the Halloween parade in New York City, there isn't that that sort of religious tradition that maybe European countries would have. Doesn't necessarily exist so much. That, how does that work for you guys as you're planning a parade and expecting an audience? I mean, you have to anticipate your audience to a certain extent. It seems like because you have such a large community involvement that as the audience is sort of creating this parade, they're in on the process and they have a very... you're educating your own audience, essentially, as you're going along. But how does that play out?
Well, I mean, this being the centennial of John Cage, I think it's worth noting that sometimes when an audience or a prospective viewer least expects to have an art experience, they are most open to it.
Mm.
So you have people that are expecting marching bands and rah-rah, and suddenly they see, you know, 13 sort of diaphanous forms with daguerreotype faces gathering around a table that's rising up through the air. The first impression a lot of people have is, oh my God, something's actually happening. You know, it isn't just marching past. There's some kind of a performance thing going on. And at that moment, there's more of an environment of discovery than presentation. People feel fortunate just to be seeing something that they hadn't expected to experience. So they're kind of on your side at that point. You know, we often tell people who are carrying giant puppets, if you can do anything at all that evokes a sense of intention, the audience will just love it. Because, you know, in the Halloween parade, they're just used to lots and lots of random costumes marching down the street.
Right.
When you suddenly see, you know, a whole bunch of, you know, memento mori calavera skeletons form themselves into a conga line, form a circle, come into the center, turn around, and go out again, that's utterly shocking. So, I mean, at a very visceral level, it brings people kind of onto your side when they see any kind of attempt at stage performance. Now, probably they're not going to walk away after we have passed by and we've done some kind of a transformation or whatever it is that we do, you know, in a given parade, and say, oh, well, they must be alluding to the history of photography and the sort of tradition of spirit photography in the late 1880s. Yeah,
I love that you had a table there as well.
It was a full lamp. I sort of started talking about the ghosts, but just that performance was a full performance with the 13 giant ghosts, a seance table that was not as visible. I mean, it existed, and then when we stopped to do the performance, it would slowly rise and bring all of the ghosts. The ghosts would sort of get sucked in like a vortex. And then all around, the space was sort of delineated by these windows. So it was like we were creating this living room without walls, because ghosts, of course, could go through the walls. It didn't matter to them. So we had 12 giant windows onto which were projected images, early images from early photography and also early Edison Films, and carried by costumed sort of ghost-like figures. And then in and amongst all of these, the space created by the windows and then the table as the center and the ghosts, were all of these sort of flying domestic objects. They were these spinning spoons and the giant tea set and all of these elements that we sort of associated with the seance, mm-hmm. that sort of aesthetic of the heavy draped Victorian living room that sort of helped create the space. So this whole performance would wander up the street, and then periodically, about every block, we would stop, and the table would start rising, and the spoons and the tea set would start spinning, and the vortex, and the table would gather all of the ghosts into the center.
And it was all fairly strictly timed. I mean, there was a 2-minute soundtrack. The ghosts were all numbered. Mm. So if you were ghost number 7, you waited for the 7th beat to sail up into the air, and then you knew you had 37 seconds to make it to the table.
So there was, I was just going to ask actually if this was scripted, if you guys worked out a story or a plot or a narrative and then practiced and...
Yeah, it was essentially the gathering of those 13 ghosts one at a time. Mm-hmm. So it goes from this environment of total chaos, mm-hmm. to something that actually assumes some kind of geometric form by the end. Mm-hmm. And you end up with 13 ghosts circling the table and then all bowing at once, almost like a flower opening its petals.
If anybody who hasn't seen a processional performance by your company, workshop, group, can't really quite understand how magic it is, because you guys managed to take what is a rather high concept and make it actual, and the potential for disaster, like from going from chaos to anarchy.
Well, and there is a lot of latitude for chaos.
Yeah,
what we do. We know that we have one.
You have a high tolerance for.
Yeah, it's built into the process.
Yeah,
and often, you know, when these figures go out, they end up doing things that we never anticipated they would do. They find, you know, sort of subscripts along the way that they end up performing. So once you put 3 people or 10 people or in some cases 40 people into a single element, they become this sort of cellular community, and they start doing things that embody this kind of ego of that character that they've created. And we're constantly surprised at what we see. So we know that there's going to be that element. We also know that there's the larger element of chaos in what is a parade, how is it staged, what's going to happen along the route, quite outside and apart from our performance unit. You know, we might have 150 people performing, but in the Halloween parade, there are 50,000 people in the parade. And there's a lot of management of that human space as well. Which sometimes, you know, you'll stage this beautiful performance, you know, underwater creatures or whatever, and there in the middle of it is Dracula carrying an American flag. And it's just like, you know, that never happens at the Met. You know, you never have,
no,
like,
no.
People
the Met,
wandering.
The Met can be unexciting at times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's a kind of surreal collision that we don't welcome it, but when it happens, it's the new reality of the piece.
And the same thing holds true to our building process, uh-huh. which is there's no way the two of us could build a performance like Ghost or any other procession that we
could
build.
Could you talk a little bit about how you wound up being such a community-based workshop?
Mm-hmm. Like, well, we started working together 14 years ago, and that on the Halloween parade.
You must have been children.
We were barely born. We didn't even exist. But somehow, Alex had designed this pretty ambitious project, and I came on to help. And it was for the 25th anniversary of the Halloween parade, and there were 5 giant Luna moths that started off as caterpillars and that periodically would shed their skins and reveal their moth form and open their wings, and there were baby moths flying around.
Like your typical parade shtick.
Exactly. Yeah. So it set precedent for our future performances. And we worked really hard. I mean, we started, I don't know, in the middle of the summer, and we worked every day, long hours, and sewing and paper macheing and doing whatever needed to be done. And at some point, we realized, I think it was in late August, and we realized there was no way we're going to get all of these done. And we really, you know, you don't want to, I mean, we're pretty flexible and we're willing to sort of make more or less or tune a project, but we really didn't want to have just 1.5 giant caterpillars turned into moths. We wanted to have the group of five and to do the performance. So
did you guys come to this conclusion simultaneously, or like when did the penny drop? Like, oh my God, we're never going to get this done.
I think we just one day realized that people wanted to do this kind of work and said, you know, we could do a little Tom Sawyer kind of thing here and ask some people to whitewash the fence, and it might just work. And
but we were desperate. I mean, we were just realizing
you could be like, desperate.
We can. I don't remember what level our desperation was, but I remember thinking like, this isn't going to work with the two of us. And because I think a few people had said, we can come help, and you know, once in a while someone would come by and would be like, can you help paper mache? So we put out a call for help. And the director of the parade got involved and sort of sent out to her mailing list. And we hired a friend of ours to cook a big meal, two big meals, lunch and dinner. And people came. I don't know how many people we had, but probably over 20 that first year. And on Saturday, and we started opening up our workshop every other Saturday, more or less.
And this is over in Barrytown.
And this is in Barrytown, our home shop. And it was fantastic because people would come and they... I just remember seeing these caterpillar bodies. Just, it was like, you know, time-lapse photography. It was just, they were going up so fast. And I had been doing most of the sewing on my own, and I was sort of like, look what, you know, 10 people sitting around chit-chatting. They can sew really fast. So the things were going up, and other people would come in and be like, I'd like to paper mache, and we're like, okay, great, here we go. And other people came in with sort of carpentry skills, and we're like, well, we're not really doing carpentry, but we need to measure and cut this PVC at this length, and we need to make this and that, and it was fantastic. And the project started growing, and it did take me certainly a couple of years to really feel comfortable with the idea that people were doing it because they wanted to do it. And initially, a lot of them were people we knew. But that they weren't exclusively doing it because they felt sorry for us for not making our deadline. That there
was that an issue for you as well, Alex?
Yeah, well, in any process, there's a letting go of control when you farm out aspects of it to other people.
Right.
But what has become apparent to us is that, you know, for example, Sophia brought up sewing.
Right.
There are people in our community who are better sewers than either of us. And nobody has asked them to sew anything in a really long time. You know, grandmas who used to remember growing up fixing their kids' clothes and stuff like that.
Yeah, nobody darns socks anymore.
No, it just does not happen. So somebody comes in and says, I can sew, and you realize, oh, you really can sew. Like, you can sew at a level that is beyond what we do. So, you know, often when people talk about community artists, it's almost like that word community is a little bit pejorative. It's saying, oh, you're doing like bad sidewalk murals with Girl Scout troops or something like that. And in fact,
is there any other kind?
You know, when you do community work, when you open yourself up and say, look, we got to do some carpentry here, the people who walk through your door very likely are going to be more precise and more committed to their little corner.
And do you find people take direction? Because I think it's interesting that, like, Sophia seemed mainly concerned that people were doing this because they pitied you.
Mm-hmm.
But then you kind of came to the conclusion that, in fact, you're doing them a favor. Or not you, but it's a balance.
It's enlightened self-interest is what it is.
And that's how this sort of community involvement began, was just enlightened self-interest.
I think that's how it works, because if we were doing it for them, like, oh, well, we'll come up with a project just to entertain people, we wouldn't be quite as exacting. Like, we're open for people to come in and, you know, do things at any level of skill, and we can usually break down a project and say, this is how you do it, and figure something out.
And people will be, oh, I'm not an artist, or I'm not really an arty, crafty person.
Oh, very much, yeah. People are like, I don't know how to do anything. I'm like, well, I'm going to show you, you can trace and cut this form out of cardboard, and I'll teach you how to do it if you've never cut with a knife. And they end up being great. And as long as they take it seriously, which most people do, when they come into a situation like this, then they do fantastic work. And they often do better work than we ourselves would do, because it's our own piece, so we might cut corners, and other people are like, no, it has to be perfect. And they they do it at a higher level of craft than we might. But they also really love being part of a larger vision and being coming in and sort of being a piece in the large, and knowing that it's not their responsibility to do the whole thing.
And do you feel like people are okay with just coming on board and sort of working with your vision?
And often what's interesting is that, I mean, sometimes there's someone who's like, I'm an expert painter and I'll do all the final painting, in which case we say, well, first you've got to paint mache, and then, we will take on most of the final painting. But but then sometimes someone comes in day after day after day, and you realize, this person really has fantastic skills. And then you start delegating more and more to people who prove themselves.
Because, I mean, it's like Alex was saying, that there are, I imagine, a lot of people who think, oh, community, anything, it's, you know, Girl Scouts on the sidewalk with, you know, pastels, and I'll come in and I'll help these people because I know how to do this and I know how to do that. And,
It's very humbling for us because it's a temptation to be very sanctimonious about doing, in quotes, community art. You know, I'm doing this wonderful thing for all of you, and you ought to look up to me for this altruistic act.
The way that you came to it, it kind of turns that on its head.
It's so exactly it's interesting. The opposite. It's saying, look, we've made these drawings, we've envisioned a performance, it's multi-layered, it's pretty sophisticated, it's pretty large scale, and if you subscribe to the value of what we have sketched out, then we're all going to benefit if you take part. And if you don't subscribe to it, if you think it's a dumb idea, or you don't like the drawings, or you don't like this whole idea, then you don't take part. So in a way, the people who help us in these workshops are a measuring stick for the validity of the ideas that we're having.
Have you ever had an idea that you thought was awesome and then people are like, and...
Well, not really.
I mean, actually, I would say that the opposite happens.
Is that right? You're like, and then everyone loves it?
No, not that we're not... there are moments, especially sticking with Halloween, and this has happened in other places, but because Halloween, we have there are people who come back year after year after year and who know our work and who obviously are therefore committed to this experience and the project and the way that we work, which is fantastic for us. But usually the first workshop, we call these puppet raisings because it really is like building on the idea of a barn raising. And it's like we even though physically very little has been made except for a few prototypes, we are revealing the idea. And it's like opening night in a way. There is that, you know, that tension.
Well, you wouldn't be an artist if you didn't have doubts.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and usually at that point we've worked through the idea. I mean, it's not like we're like, well, maybe we'll do some ghosts or maybe we'll do, or like, this is what we're doing. But it's so great to see the confirmation in people's faces when they get it. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's fantastic. And then they start giving us feedback, whether they have worked with us in the past or not, about like, that's really great. I was just thinking about that the other day because, or they come in with their own interpretation, or they give us the dimensions of the idea that maybe we hadn't considered and don't necessarily feed directly into the idea, but are part of what the interpretation will be from other people, which as artists is fantastic to have that feedback immediately, you know, that people are sitting there, not only are they going to come and see it, see the piece, but they're helping build it and they're thinking about it and they spend all day paper macheing a form with other people and then they eventually start talking about it and they
and you're
they
spreading, you're spreading art like a virus.
Exactly, that's what we'd like to do.
So you talked a little bit about your vision for Halloween that you did last year. Was that the ghosts?
No, ghosts was 2008.
Oh, 2008.
Yeah.
But you're still haunted by that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I brought it up as an example because sometimes our themes are more abstract. Like, that was looking at a cliche.
More abstract than, yeah.
I mean, there's two ways to go with Halloween.
Yeah.
And I mean, Halloween certainly is not the only thing that we do.
Right, right.
Halloween will either take a cliche, an archetype of Halloween, like the classic Peanuts ghost sheet with two holes poked in it, or, and then we'll deepen that. We'll try to figure out, where does that come from? What are its origins? What's the backstory behind something like a jack-o'-lantern?
You know? Uh-huh.
And then retell that story in a way that it teases out some of its historical antecedents, some of its cultural antecedents. The other way to go about it is to start with a theme like metamorphosis, or last year was Eye of the Beholder, where it was about disembodied vision and the archetype of the floating eye or the disembodied eye, and how that relates to technology and communications in the current era. How so much of our experience is mediated, it's experienced through screens, through YouTube and things like that.
Mm-hmm. That's why I work exclusively in audio.
Right. Yeah, you're completely immune to that sort of thing. But but you know, for a lot of people, we were noticing how many people were watching the parade through their cell phone cameras.
Oh yeah.
You know, the main idea behind it was just that I bring it up because we don't always take the Halloween narrative. Sometimes it's a completely alien narrative to Halloween that is simply its own standalone theme that we want to work through, whether it's metamorphosis or evolution or, you know, any of the others that we've done. So we bounce back and forth between, you know, reinvestigating cliched traditions and doing things that are completely alien to the kind of pantheon of stock Halloween types.
It was a zombie jamboree, took place in a New York cemetery. It was a zombie jamboree, took place in a New York cemetery. Zombies from all parts of the island, some of them was a great Calypsonians. Though the season was carnival, they get together in Bacchanal and they singing back to back, belly to belly. I don't give a damn, I done dead already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. I hear you talking, back to back, belly to belly, don't give a damn, done dead already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. One female zombie wouldn't behave, see how she jumping out of the grave. In one hand, a quarter rum, the other hand she knocking conga drum. The lead singer start to make his rhyme, the zombies are rattling their bones in time. One bystander had this to say, was a pleasure to see the zombie break away. And they're singing, back to back, belly to belly, don't give a damn, done dead already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. I go and talk to Bridget Bardot, I tell her Miss Bardot, take it slow. All the men think they're Casanova when they see that she's barefoot all over. Even old men out in Topeka find their hearts getting weaker and weaker. So I go ask her, for your sake and mine, at least wear her earrings part of the time. And I'm singing, back to back, belly to belly, don't give a damn, done dead already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. A lot of world leaders talking about war, and I'm afraid they're going too far. So it's up to us, you and me, to put an end to catastrophe. We must appeal to their goodness of heart and ask them to pitch in and please do their part. Cause if this atomic war begin, they won't even have a part to pitch in. And we'll be singing.
So now that you're preparing now for Sinterklaas,
mm-hmm.
Now how's your vision sort of translate to, it seems to be a more traditional procession. What are your What are your concepts for? Change every year? Is it
traditional? Is a loaded word in any kind of carnivalesque art, because carnival doesn't actually, in some sense, know tradition. Carnival evolves with each year. It's always perpetually contemporary. So,
if you could maybe give a brief history of the evolution of carnival, mm-hmm. or processions. If you can keep it.
Yeah, under a 24-hour.
We can talk for years about that.
Well, I'll do two.
You had
shows
mentioned
on this.
Earlier, like the fact that people, when they see a parade, they have certain preconceptions about a parade, and that's partly true because people have costumed themselves, created ceremonial architecture, and in a sense told kind of abstract narratives. From the Greek mysteries back to the Egyptians. I mean, this idea of a movable performance that goes from point A to point B and consecrates the space in between.
Now, does that predate sort of theater as we understand it? Like, where there's a stage and it's static?
Well, I think it's shared roots. I mean, you know, the Greek theatrical traditions all began with invocations. You know, they were considered a quasi-religious event.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think theater and ritual are intertwined in a way that, you know, you're never going to be able to unravel them. Even you know, going to Broadway now, when the curtain rises and there's durational stuff and there's the way that acts are broken up, all of that is you know, in some sense grafted onto a ritual tradition of how theater happens. There's no reason why there needs to be a proscenium and a curtain and all of that, but those are conventions the theater has arrived at over time. And anybody who's ever worked in theater knows about all the superstitions about, you know, never whistle on a stage, never utter the name of Macbeth in a theater. You know, there's all kinds of backstage sort of mumbo jumbo that goes on. And, you know, I think if you flip it around the other way, when people get married or they have a funeral, mm-hmm. those things are extremely theatrical. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a rehearsal for a wedding. Why? Because it's a performance and you want to get it right. You don't want to screw it up.
Right.
There's a script that you have to follow and recite. You know, there are certain moments that have to be done in a certain sequence.
Well, I mean, that's interesting you bring that up, because I've often thought that those scripts for those highly charged life events mm-hmm. are, for most people, very necessary.
Yeah.
Because it frees you to feel the things that you need to feel, rather than think about what you have to say and where you got to stand and what you have to
yeah.
do.
And it's one of the problems that people are facing these days, is that in the absence of religion,
mm-hmm.
You don't have an instruction manual for how to deal with a death, how to deal with a marriage,
yeah.
how to deal with a birth. And, you know, leaving aside sort of teleological concerns of who are we, where did we come from, what kind of God is there a God, what, you know, how does, to what extent does he or she interfere with our lives? Leaving all of that aside, I think what draws a lot of people to ritual is simply, it's just the calmness of a repeated and unquestioned act
mm-hmm.
to say, this is what we do when somebody dies.
Yeah.
You know, if you're Jewish, you sit Shiva. If you're a Catholic, you might have a different ritual, but you basically don't have to work out the necessary response to essentially an inconceivable and unrespondable act.
Yeah.
So,
and it connects you to people who have sat Shiva for thousands of years, and you become a part of the whole process
yeah.
of life and death when you engage in these rituals.
And in some sense, it could be a completely absurd act that you do. You know, you must always drink, you know, grape Kool-Aid at the time that a child is born. Well, why not? You know, if that were done over and over again, that would be the thing that
it would
people
be
do
so.
To mark
yes.
that moment, you know. So, you know, and of course I grew up in a Jewish tradition where it was like we had to eat gefilte fish once a year, and it's just like, that's about as absurd as it gets.
And that's,
like,
that's about all you can, that's about, and that's about all you can handle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once a year, you know. Cut through that gelatinous encasement and into the
yeah.
cold lump of white fish.
No,
but
there's no
I
difference
forward
between
to
good
it.
Gefilte fish and bad gefilte fish.
Right.
Yeah.
But I look forward to it because it was like, ah, point of continuity in my life. A year has passed
mm-hmm.
since
mm-hmm.
I have last done this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I'm doing it. I don't understand the context for it, but this is just what we do. And there's a kind of release that happens when you give yourself up to an action that simply, for inscrutable reasons, must be undertaken. So, bringing that back to Sinterklaas,
yes.
There are various elements in this procession that were made 25 years ago before we were even involved, and they always, these elements come out, and nobody knows what they mean. Nobody knows why there's a big blue dog on a litter that's being carried through the parade. Nobody knows why there's a tiger.
Somebody must know why there's a big... Well, the people who made them don't know why.
Yeah. Why it's there. Yeah. I mean, there's some, there is a bit of a context of why some of it exists, but not the specifics. And then they stick with us, and we still bring them out.
Which is really nice, because then if you want to sort of take a Jungian dichotomy here, Jung would talk about allegory and he talked about symbol. And allegory was this A stands for B kind of linear relationship. Oh, the blue dog is a symbol of XYZ. And so if we did XYZ, we wouldn't need the blue dog. One stands for the other. That's metaphor, and it's pretty basic. Symbol, on the other hand, is an image that can be X, it can be Y, or it can be Z, and it depends on how you're slicing the apple, what kind of message you're going to get. And that's really where the power of, you know, allowing a certain amount of inscrutability and absurdity into any artistic act is important. You really don't want to make a photograph or a painting that is making a statement that could be written on a piece of paper and say, this is what this painting means. You know, which is what so many people
You're taking the audience out of the equation.
Right.
You're denying them.
Yeah, you're reducing it to the audio guide version of art. I get it now. This work has been decoded for me. So when people look at our work and they say, gosh, you guys have done all this research, but are they going to get it? It's like, well, they're going to get something. I mean, 2 minutes of imagery, you know, assembling and disassembling before their eyes with some very specific cultural signifiers doing a very specific thing is going to leave residue, you know, visual residue as it passes by. And it's so brief, you know, what we do. It's not a two-hour performance. There's no explanation. There's no pamphlet that's handed out. It's there. It flashes in your eyes, and then it disappears. It moves on down the street. And what you're left with is the things that you've managed to sort of cling to in your memory of the thing, and then you start sorting out what it is that you've experienced. So there's a great quote, I'm going to misquote him, but Paul Valéry is a French poet, and he talks about the gap between seeing and understanding, or hearing and understanding in the case of poetry. And it's the period of time before you've come to an understanding, meaning you've sort of compromised with the work and said, all right, I have agreed on this interpretation of what I've experienced. But before that moment comes, there's this long period of chaos in your mind where you're just trying to use every experience you've ever had in your life to grasp onto the absurdity that you've experienced. And you're finding connections and confluences and associations. You're doing what intelligence actually is designed to do, which is to find connections among disparate things.
Yeah.
And in that moment, which for some people is 5 minutes, for some people it's the rest of your life, you know, you look at a Henri Rousseau painting, and you say, I still can't figure out what that lion is doing there, and it's haunting me, you know. But, you may never come to an understanding with that work.
Yeah.
And that's really the experience we're trying to deliver. Mm-hmm. It's not, whatever interpretation they have is fine with me. That's not fine with me. But, you know, which is why we've chosen and curated certain imagery and sounds and choreographies in certain ways.
But there is space.
But within, you know, within 7 and 8 on the yardstick, there's an infinity of fractional positions. Mm-hmm. And so we're expecting the audience, when this thing has passed on and given them this experience, to within those two parameters that we've established, have an infinitude of possible fractional experiences, a lot of which consists of them grafting their personal experience, their baggage. It's not baggage, because it actually is what ennobles and enlightens us, but their lifelong experience onto the experience that they're witnessing.
Uh-huh.
And for a lot of people, it's amazing how close to our sort of manifesto artist statement that we begin with, they've come in their interpretation. You know, they'll see in Ghosts, they'll see, well, there's obviously windows and things flickering in the windows. Mm-hmm. Everybody can see that.
Mm-hmm.
So they're ghostly apparitions, but they're clearly from a time period that is around 1900. And, you know, when I read H.P. Lovecraft, I realized that he was coming out of a context of spiritualism in the end of the 19th century, at a time when religion was sort of fragmenting and becoming less obligatory. Suddenly, people have stepped into that history.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not have done the exact research that we've done, but they're going to start digging deeper to try to make sense of what initially, at first experience, was, I won't say nonsensical, but not immediately sort of nip and tuck, oh, this is a perfect allegory for that.
Mm-hmm. So Santa Claus. So what's your idea for Santa Claus this year? What are some of the challenges?
Some of the projects we do, we're complete authors of.
Okay.
You know, we say, all right, we've gotten a commission to do a project in Morningside Park. We can do whatever we want. We write out a theme. We have a concept. And there are other projects that we're really more facilitators for. We're basically brought on to help organize, construct, and build upon a processional tradition that already exists. So
in Rhinebeck, for Santa Claus.
Yeah. So each year there is a new honored animal, and that becomes the core focus of the workshops that we do.
Okay. Why?
Why not?
Because years ago, when Dutch Christmas, which is now what Sinterklaas has become,
uh-huh,
was staged, there was a different honored animal each year. And I know that that's not a satisfactory answer, but that's the answer we've got.
Because this is the way it's always been done.
Right.
And that goes back to sort of ritual and tradition.
And it's
we
way
don't
more
really
fun
know.
Than having an honored plant.
We
do have honored fungi. We do have Amanita muscaria mushrooms in the parades.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Actual ones or just roughly?
Well, they're three feet wide.
Okay.
But they bounce and spin.
Which is related to the whole, you know, pagan origins of Santa Claus. And, you know, they're red and white
and
hallucinogenic.
And well.
And, you know, there's a
is
reason
why
right? reindeer fly.
Okay, because you've just completely validated my show in that I can now tie this into foraging.
Exactly.
Because Santa Claus has its origins in tripping mushrooms.
But we are foraging for meaning in all of these events, so.
Well, yeah, no, that's.
You are part, too.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the time, I think these connections that people make, it's not a causal, like, this happened and that caused that to happen. You know, there were hallucinogenic mushrooms, they were red and white, and that's why Santa Claus wears red and white. Well, no, not really. But sometimes you'll have multiple.
If we repeat it long enough, it will make it so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or we see this in Trinidad Carnival all the time. There are multiple meanings,
mm-hmm,
attached to one object.
Mm.
And so that object is retained year after year because it resonates with so many different interpretations.
Hmm.
You know, one of the examples in Trinidad is there's a character called the Fancy Sailor. And the Fancy Sailor started out as a mockery of the American military presence, and before that, the British military presence
right.
in Trinidad, which was, you know,
a long-standing naval garrison that was there.
The fight,
and they would, of course, come on during shore leave on land, and they would wreak havoc, as sailors will. And they, you know, there were prostitutes, and they were getting drunk.
And when the Yankees first went to Trinidad, some of the young girls were more than glad. They said that the Yankees treat them nice, and they give them a better price. They buy rum and Coca-Cola, went down Point Kumana. Both mothers and daughters working for their Yankee dollar. And Coca-Cola, going down Point Kumana. Both mother and daughter working for the Yankee dollar. And look, I had a little chick the other day, but her mother came and took her away. Herself, her mother, and her sisters went in a cab with some soldiers. They bought rum and Coca-Cola, went down Point Kumana, both mothers and daughters.
The sailors, they carry this stick with them. And the costumes over time, they've gone from being simple sailor suits where they're wearing long Caucasian noses, which
that,
are not really noses,
yeah.
But that's, you know, there's allegory for you. But they do this whole dance where they pretend that they're drunk or they're on board a rocking ship where they sway from side to side.
Uh-huh.
And that has become stylized over the years. And the sailor costumes after the Navy left in the early 60s when Trinidad got into independence became encrusted with other sort of tourist tchotchkes, and they became embodiments of Pan-African nationalism, and they became mockeries of Chinese stereotypes, and they became Hawaiian umbrella drinks, and they became, you know, they just started sprouting. They became these mobile, surreal juxtapositions that were worn on these huge harnesses. So some of them are 15, 20 feet tall. And the guy carrying them is doing this bizarre Michael Jackson moonwalk. In fact, Michael Jackson may have gotten his moonwalk watching these guys do their thing. Because they're gliding across the street. And all of that, and beneath all of that, they still have the stick. So what
is the bell bottoms.
And the bell bottoms.
There are a few elements that hark back to the early days, but since the Navy is no longer the nemesis, but maybe tourism is, or imported goods are, or whatever it is, they sort of lose the original meaning, but it's still there underneath it all. And the movement is the most important. I mean, that's how you can recognize a fancy sailor.
But the reason I bring them up is that some of the elements that they carry, you'll hear Trinidadian anthropologists say, oh, well, the stick means this. No, the stick means that. And it's like the wise man and the elephant. The stick means all of those things. That sailors, by the way, never carried sticks. Like, you don't, that's not part of the standard U.S. naval uniform. You don't carry a cane with you. So, but that is instrumental to the sailor costume. They all have them. So why do they have them? Well, some people will say it comes from Cambrulé, which was the original carnival where they were burning the sugar fields and they were carrying sugar cane on fire through the streets. And they were burning the sugar cane because that was their instrument of slavery. That was the reason why there were slaves in Trinidad in the first place. And then other people say, no, it has nothing to do with Cambrulé. It has to do with Kalenda, which was an Angolan stick-fighting tradition that also has, was one of the roots of Capoeira. And you'll see Trinidadians today doing this ritualized stick fight. And they'll say, it's purely African. It has nothing to do with the burning of the cane fields. And then somebody else will say, no. It's because for tourists, you know, when the ships would come into Trinidad and into Port of Spain, they would carve canes out of mango wood and sell them as tourist items. Because mango wood is really hard, and it's this beautiful wood to carve. And, you know, it has nothing to do with any kind of ancient African or slave tradition. It's completely a modern-day commercial thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody else, you know, maybe more Freudian inclined, will say, no, it's a phallus. You know, they're carrying an embodiment of the sexual aggression of naval sailors. So who's right? You know, they're all right. And that's why there still is a cane, because it works for so many different interpretations that it stays. It's like an evolutionary process. Other elements that might have been referential to one very specific historical thing, but didn't really have that crossover association, those things have disappeared. So, you know, if you see a carnival character, this is why I say tradition is very problematic in carnival, as a kind of organism that with each replication is mutating a little bit, and the traits that are conducive to survival are retained, and the ones that are not don't get carried on, you basically have a meme. You have this mimetic process by which a given costume element will either continue unchanged, or it'll continue and grow into something bigger, or it'll disappear altogether because people don't get it. They don't. They're like, why is he carrying a stick? I don't know. So it's one of the interesting things to look at, because
But it gets people thinking. It gets people thinking anyway.
It's symbol rather than allegory. It's back to that Jungian divide. You know, it stands for many, many things at once, and it just is what it is. It's just a stick. A blue dog is a blue dog.
A blue dog is a blue dog.
And he's the hound from hell to some people, and he's Santa's helper to others, and he's, you know, the blue dog painter from L.A., I forget his name, you know, to other people. You know, he's referential to so many things.
See, I thought Clifford's brother.
Right, could be Clifford's brother, you know. So, you know, some of these things we sort of embrace.
So you've got the big blue dog, because it's always been there. And there's an honored animal, because an honored animal in Dutch...
has nothing to do with Dutch tradition whatsoever.
It doesn't.
Yeah. So the honored animal is where... Well, let me backtrack. It has to do with Dutch traditions in the sense that the Dutch, as they manifested their colonization in this country, were legendarily tolerant and open to just about anything. So long as you were making money, it didn't matter if you were Native American, Jewish, Catholic, whatever. You know, they were Dutch Reform, but they didn't really, you know, they were all about just come here, earn your keep, improve the fortunes of the Dutch East India Company, and you're good to go. So Sinterklaas, in some ways, is a celebration of that. It's a celebration of this kind of universalist acceptance of whatever comes down the street. So part of that, I think the honored animal really has its roots in kind of the organizer's way of honoring their perception of Native American traditions, in which animals might have a more prominent role than in, say, a Dutch Reform church ceremony. So, you know, Native Americans have a lot of mythologies about spirit animals and you know, creation myths that deal with turtles and ravens and various other things. So I think that's where the kind of honoring of the pre-Dutch tradition comes into Sinterklaas. But that's my interpretation. From a sheerly strategic standpoint, it just enables us to continue shifting themes from year to year without having to say, this year's Dutch Christmas theme is... You know, and then we'd have to go through, I don't know, bells for different songs. I mean, animals are inexhaustible. And with every animal comes a host of stories. So every year at the end of the parade, there's an invocation that's written by Gigi Alvarez, who's this great community artist who used to live in Rhinebeck and now lives elsewhere. But she dials in the convocation or the invocation of the animal. And then there's other things. There are the Abbots Bromley dancers who wear antlers and do a medieval court dance very softly and quietly. Like I think they think of themselves as being quite raucous. They're like Morris dancers, but they're very well-behaved Morris dancers. You know?
Are Morris dancers raucous?
Well, they clack sticks together.
Right.
There's this druidic Shalila thing that's going on that I don't fully understand, but they're great. And then various brass bands. I think the Hungry March Band will probably be there, and various other groups that have been brought in. But in the parade itself, it really is, you know, a whole set of sort of random juxtapositions of various elements. You know, there's the idea of toys and mechanisms and automata that is one section. There's celestial objects that is another section. There are these stars with anthropomorphic faces. And that's the Seven Sisters.
But a lot of these are categories that we sort of developed to make sense of the somewhat absurd collection that we inherited from the original event, which ran for a few years in the 80s, mm-hmm. and then was dormant until 5 years ago.
Which is a complete jumble of signifiers.